Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Toby Jones, a professor of Middle East history at Rutgers University and the author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. His work focuses primarily on the political intersections between science, technology, the environment, knowledge production, and the state formation, war, and Islamism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Toby Jones.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And clearly, Saudi Arabia is taking the lead along with Qatar in trying to get rid of the regime of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. I believe that I don't know how much covert money and covert arms are slipping in, but my understanding is that the Qataris have actually provided a brigade that was trained in Libya. It does seem that we're heading towards a civil war there. But what's so hypocritical, it seems, is the idea that the Saudi Arabians are the champions of rushing to the aid of those abused by dictators when they routinely repress their own people.
That's right. They repress their own people. They repress their neighbors' people. And remember, it was just a year ago. It'll be a year ago on March 14th. Saudi Arabia sent a military contingent into Bahrain to quell a pro-democracy uprising there. So I think you're certainly right to identify a kind of paradox, contradiction in the Saudi position in calling for an end to the bloodshed and suffering that Syrians are enduring at the hands of a brutal tyrant. But it would be a mistake to conclude that the Saudis are either sympathetic with the interests of Syrian revolutionaries, that they seek to see a democratic outcome there, or that they're even a little bit concerned about humanitarian issues or suffering. The Saudis have a political agenda, and winning Syria for the Saudis is all about winning the regional balance of power game. Checking Iranian ambition, creating a weak regime in Damascus is probably Riyadh's primary objective. Certainly not preventing a civil war or aiding the cause of those in Syria, like in Homs, who are suffering terribly.
And Toby Jones, during the Egyptian Revolution, the Saudi king was on the phone every day screaming at President Obama to allow Mubarak to kill the kids in Tahrir Square and to quash the revolution. And of course, obviously the president didn't listen to him. And the long and the short of it is, how have the Saudi royals managed to avoid the Arab Spring? Because clearly, given their position vis-a-vis supporting Musharraf and the extent to which they funded the Salafists in Egypt now, who have done very well in the elections, clearly they are the royal family are terrified of the Arab Spring.
There's no doubt about it. I mean, when events, when Egypt didn't do, went through its stages of protest, 18 days of protest last year, and when Mubarak fell, of course, the Saudis were terrified. I mean, there was a deep sense of anxiety in Riyadh about what this might portend. It was also last February that events in Syria and Yemen and Bahrain broke out. So they certainly felt besieged. And it's been the pattern of Saudi behavior over the last year to pursue more or less a counter-revolutionary agenda. That might seem at odds with how they're claiming to support the revolution in Syria or even the role that they played in Libya. But those still, I believe, and would argue, fit the model, or at least are consistent with Saudi Arabia's desire to crush democratic movements in the region and to turn them into something else or to defeat them. And you're right, in Egypt, of course, Saudi Arabia was terrified and was deeply unnerved by the prospect of Mubarak falling and wanted to see him do whatever it would take to stay in power. It's also interesting that in the post-Mubarak Egypt, that Riyadh, while the Saudis are certainly ideologically inclined to support some sectors of the religious establishment in Egypt, Salafis and others, they're also throwing their weight behind the military regime because they believe that's the ticket to stability. And the kind of Mubarakism without Mubarak is certainly something the Saudis would like to preserve. Closer to home, the Saudis have used a number of different instruments, everything from coercion and the use of violence against their own protest movement, which is actually pretty significant in some parts of the country, as well as a set of inducements using a ton of money. Over the course of 2011, the Saudis pledged somewhere on the order of $130 to $140 billion in new spending designed to address the sorts of social despair and social frustrations that a lot of its citizens harbor. But this is a place, in spite of considerable oil wealth and considerable oil reserves, has upwards of 20% unemployment and upwards of 20% who live below the line of poverty. So certainly the conditions in Saudi Arabia are there for it to see or to experience the Arab Spring as well. It just hasn't happened yet.
Well, apparently the Saudi population is growing rapidly. I believe it's up to 28 million now, and it's a very young demographic we're talking about. And my understanding is, even though there hasn't been very good polling and the Saudis basically protect their image and the press seem to sort of pretty much get spoon-fed what the government wants. My understanding, and maybe it's biased because it comes from some of the Saudi opposition figures, is that the young people in Saudi Arabia are extremely restless and repressed. And if there were to be an Arab Spring, it would have a very secular nature in Saudi Arabia.
Well, I wouldn't want to predict what the character of the uprising would be. I think on the one hand, I think if there was going to be one, so let's say a hypothetical uprising, a revolutionary movement in Saudi Arabia, what would it look like? I think you're right to identify a deep sense of disillusion in some sectors of Saudi society, whether it's a generational issue or whether it's a regional issue. Remember, Saudi Arabia is a huge place, roughly one-third the size of the United States, and there's geographic variety, there's cultural and religious variety and complexity within Saudi Arabia. And that could be a potential strength. Not all Saudis for a revolutionary movement. Not all Saudis identify either with the Al Saud or with the brand of Islamic orthodoxy that they promote and embrace officially. So there's a lot of bristling against Saudi political authority, against corruption, against excess, against violence. But for the very same reason that there's complexity in Saudi Arabia, it also makes a revolutionary movement difficult to pull off logistically. I mean, the organizational effort that would have to go into an Egyptian-style uprising or even a Bahraini-style uprising would be significant. Saudis would have to overcome a powerful security apparatus, but also geography, I mean, far distant cities with different social and cultural traditions and relationships. In some way, Saudi Arabian society is deeply atomized and divided, and Saudis have to figure out a way, if in fact the vast majority want this, they have to figure out a way to overcome all of that to pursue political change. That would have to happen before you'd see large street protests in the kingdom.
Well, it seems to me, though, Toby Jones, that the using the Wahhabi religious police, the Mutawahin, the House of Saud essentially uses them as a form of control over the population. Not that the House of Saud don't also have their own police and military and intelligence organs as well. In fact, the next leader may well be the fellow in charge of that apparatus, but. My understanding is, and the reason I suggested maybe there's a kind of secular reaction to this religious oppression, is that if you essentially control people's lives in the way that the religious police do, to the point where women can't drive, they're essentially obsessed with the your body. You can't date. You can't do just about anything. It's a lot. What a lot of feminists say about the attempts on the part of religious rights to the religious right in this country to control their body is that once you control, if you control somebody's body, you control them totally. We control their mind. Is that do you follow my train of thought here? I know I'm rambling a little bit.
No. I think that's right. I think there are a number of sources of frustration, and certainly. The social control, the effort by central authorities in collusion with religious authorities to both project a kind of morality and to claim credibility and legitimacy based on religious grounds, and then to use that claim to legitimacy as an instrument of social control certainly generates all kinds of frustration. But over the last 30 years or so, and this is not something that should be discounted, in addition to what we might identify as liberal or secular forces of opposition, and they certainly exist, it's not a perfect way to describe what goes on in Saudi Arabia, but for the convenience of kind of, you know, as a shorthand, it does make sense in this conversation to say that there are liberal secular forces in Saudi Arabia that oppose efforts of social control. But there are also, pious Muslims who identify both politically and religiously along, a different kind, they embrace a different kind of Islamic philosophy or interpretation, are also mobilized for precisely those reasons, that they're not Wahhabis. They could be Shiites. They could be non-Salafi Sunnis. They could be anything. They could even be Salafi Sunnis, and they oppose the kinds of measures and injunctions that are dictated by the Saudi state and by the religious authorities, the religious police included. So what I'm suggesting is that yes, there is. I think you're absolutely right that there is an avowedly liberal strain within the Saudi political opposition, but there's also an Islamist strain to it, and we should, it's not like the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, but it's also maybe not too far distant from that. And, that has the power to be revolutionary. We may not think it's progressive, but it has the power to be revolutionary anyway.
So, Toby Jones, are you referring to the more the broader kind of more inclusive and less xenophobic and austere form of Islam, because the Wahhabis are relatively recent, and Mecca and Medina were traditionally had a much broader menu, if you will, of Islamic traditions, and the Wahhabis essentially have dominated Islam, and they've, I think, in many ways, arguably, they've had a pretty detrimental effect throughout the world. They've, after all, financed and helped create the Taliban and reactionary forces inside of Pakistan and all throughout Africa, even in Nigeria as we speak. They've had the they're responsible for a kind of form of religious imperialism, if you will, with their petrodollars, but back in at home at the very heart of Islam, my understanding is there's much greater diversity that has not been extinguished by the main Wahhabi orthodoxy.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, Wahhabism means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. It's been around in one form or another for since the late 18th century, and it's been tied directly to Saudi political and economic ambitions ever since. And really, I'm not sure we'd be having this conversation about Saudi Arabia, its importance, or about Wahhabism's ability to spread globally and its corrosive influence if it wasn't for the discovery of oil. I mean, the Saudis hit the jackpot. They got lucky. And they got lucky that they discovered this resource, and of course it wouldn't have been discovered, in a moment of, and when the global industrial economy becomes almost entirely dependent upon it. So Wahhabism certainly has enjoyed a heyday over the last 50 or 60 years in Saudi Arabia, and the kingdom has sought to export it. But you're right that as is the case everywhere, in any place in Saudi Arabia, there is incredible heterogeneity. There's cultural complexity. There's religious complexity. People aren't brainwashed in Saudi Arabia. They believe lots of different things. Sure, there are devout Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia who support the regime and who support the religious institutions and the religious establishment, but there are lots who don't. But for those who don't, the obstacles to mobilization are considerable. There is, again, there's this powerful security apparatus. The Saudis are well-armed, and they're trained in the arts of counter-revolution, mostly by the Americans, but also by other European arms suppliers and militaries. And Saudis are well aware of that. They've watched what's unfolded across the region, and I've written this on a number of different occasions, that if Saudis were inclined to engage in revolutionary politics, and if they wondered what their regime or how their regime would respond to them, they need look no further than Bahrain, where the Saudis played, you know, an important role in crushing the uprising, a violent role, but also to Syria. And here's at the heart of the hypocrisy of the Saudi statement about supporting, you know, that you pointed out a few moments ago, Saudi Arabia supporting the overthrow of Assad, the Saudis would respond exactly the same way. And so that's a significant barrier to revolutionary politics, in spite of the complexity. And I think you're absolutely correct that if you could take a safe poll, if you could gauge public opinion, you'd find there's a great deal of disfavor and dislike for the Al-Saud. Not many people see them as legitimate political rulers in the kingdom.
Let me get a sense, though, of what the big secret in Saudi Arabia is actually how much oil they have, and they're spending tons and tons of money. You've said they got 20% unemployment. They're trying to buy off the young, and obviously every time, in spite of their tensions with Iran, they're profiting from the tensions as the price of gas goes up, largely due to speculation on Wall Street, is my understanding. But the long and the short is we don't know how long their supplies are going to last, and if they don't have what they say they have, aren't they in huge trouble?
Well, they're in huge trouble even if they have what they say they have, right? I mean, so, you know, because the Saudis have a number of domestic economic problems that they have to overcome. One, you mentioned already the growing population. And if we think about what oil states do and how they attempt to manage themselves and how they attempt to manage domestic politics, they take their oil wealth and they redistribute it in the form of social services, right? Whether it's welfare, health care, education, building infrastructure, providing direct employment, subsidies, housing, all kinds of other things. That gets very expensive as the population grows. But the Saudis also do something else, and they started this in the late 1970s. They began subsidizing domestic industry and agriculture and all kinds of stuff, which required things like water that the kingdom doesn't have, and as well as other resources. It became very expensive to maintain a national subsidy program where basically they were underwriting the cost of electricity and water provision and all kinds of other things. But also, Saudi Arabia has over 30 desalination plants in which it draws on Red Sea and Persian Gulf water in order to provide fresh water for agriculture but also for domestic consumption. Those plants require a considerable amount of energy themselves, right? They generate electricity, but they also require either oil or more likely natural gas to be fueled. So the Saudis, if you see Saudi Arabia as it's a place with a growing population where the provision of social services are getting more expensive and that is using a significant portion of its oil production for domestic purposes, oil that it could sell on global markets, it's under tremendous economic pressure. And the reality is the Saudis have to make sure that the floor price of oil, the baseline price of oil, is high enough for them to be able to service all of those competing needs. And right now, that floor price is around $100 a barrel. About 6 years ago, it was $45 a barrel. So the Saudis are under tremendous pressure to keep prices high. The way they manage that is they manufacture scarcity. So here I'll push back a little bit against fears that the Saudis might run out. I don't actually think the Saudis are going to run out of oil in the next 50 or 60 years. I think they've got plenty in the ground. But what they'll do is they'll keep oil from coming to market. They'll limit production. Just a few weeks ago, at the height of, now I said it's an ongoing height, but the crisis with Iran, oil sanctions, worries about Iran closing off the Strait of Hormuz, but also the Obama administration leading an international charge to limit Iran's ability to profit from the sale of oil. What did the Saudis do? They cut production, which had the effect of spiking the price of oil. And that is consistent with the kind of domestic anxiety and domestic problems that they have. So even if oil is not a scarce resource, even if they have plenty, they're under tremendous pressure to make it seem like it's a scarce resource and to jack up the price as high as we will tolerate. And that's the key thing that the Saudis are constantly thinking through and worrying about. What is the maximum price of oil that they can sustain before the West, and the United States in particular, will begin looking for alternative sources of energy?
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Toby Jones.
No, it's good to be with you. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Toby Jones, Professor of Middle East History at Rutgers University, and the author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.